Well, greetings, y'all. It's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon. It's the best of the Bob McCowan podcast, as we are going to take a couple of weeks and let you listen to some of the things we've done over the past year. Some hockey, boxing, and then more hockey. Marty Brodeur and Darren Pang, couple of targets. Teddy Atlas and Paul Jones on boxing. And Ray Ferraro and his wife, Tammy Granato,
on you can you can learn how to be a good goalie. You can learn how to be a good goalie with Marty Brodeur, Bob.
Already know how to do that.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, well, you tell you show me your Mr. Zero awards.
I've never claimed to be a good goalie. The last time I had goalie pads on, I think they were Eaton's catalogs.
Well, we all remember those days.
Sure, looking at them for the Christmas gifts. Anyway, Merry Christmas, Bob.
Merry Christmas. It's a little early, but here's the best of the Bob McCowan podcast. We are back. It's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon with the program for a Tuesday. We are in the midst, as we know, of the Stanley Cup semifinal. Are we? Is that how we describe it now?
Is that is correct? There's no conferences, Bob. There's no conferences. No East. No West. No Clarence Campbell, Prince Will. Even though, as we talked with Bill on Friday, they are going to give the trophies away at the end of this round. But there's no East West. It's called the National Hockey League Stanley Cup Semifinals.
What a mess! They're giving away a trophy, but they're not acknowledging that there are even conferences. I don't get it, but.
Well, you don't have to.
That's exactly right. I don't have to. So therefore, I'm not even going to try. Here are a couple of people who know way more than I, and probably more than you, Shannon, about all things hockey. Ray Ferraro with TSN, Cammy Granato, a scout with the new Seattle franchise yet to be launched in the National Hockey League. And a couple as well. And you were saying you're not sure this may be the first podcast, for lack of a better term, that you guys have done together at the same time?
Podcast, I'm almost certain it's the first.
I think so. It might be.
I don't know that anybody's really thought that the two of us together would be a great idea. So
apparently the producer thought it would be a good idea. I don't understand either, but apparently the producer thought, hey, you know what? They got an interesting story when you think about gold medals and NHL games and, you know, do you diagram plays at the dinner table or what do you do?
I would say we've always discussed the game. Of course, it's been such a central point of both our lives. But since Cammy's become a scout and now is watching the league at a level far deeper than, you know, more than just as fans, as we watched it before. Like her opinion on players is more detailed. I'm finding out I'm wrong way more than I used to be about players. So
well, is that in hockey or at home?
Oh, no, home. I'm in second place. I think fair to say. Well, she's not even going to disagree because I'm so far in second place. It's not even close, but it's really cool and really fun to debate what we're watching, like what just is going on in the game. Because as I said, she's watching it now at a level that of course you weren't before, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, we talk hockey. I mean, it's always been fun for us to project players or just talk about hockey because we know. It is definitely at a different level now that I'm dissecting things the way I am with my job. It's been a lot more debates and just conversations.
Do you want to tell them the first time we did this and I was so wrong?
Well, there were a few.
No, but yeah. But in Chicago.
I like to think those as big victories when I am right. But this one I think would have been obvious to other people. It wasn't to me. It wasn't to Ray, but he didn't think Patrick Kane was ready. We watched him at rookie camp and I'm like, this kid's going to be a star. And he's like, no way. And I was like,
because Jonathan Taves was at the same camp. They both came to camp the same year. I said, well, Taves is a man among boys here. He's ready to play. And she kept, like, her eye kept going to Kane. And she's like, he's ready. I'm like, look at him. He's 160 pounds. He can't play. And then he won the rookie of the year. And, you know,
Yeah. I mean, that one, I mean, I can take credit for, but I mean, anyone, I mean, it's Patrick Kane. So I don't know.
Cammy, as broadcasters, we watch games differently than normal people watch games. We're looking for certain things. I'm intrigued, Cammy, have you noticed a change in the way you watch games now that your job is to do that specifically, not as a fan, but as a scout?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, when typically watching a game, I would watch the puck. I'd follow the puck and follow the play. But now as a scout, when you're looking at a certain guy, you have to look at them off the puck as well. And so it's very different. I mean, it's not different in the way the game's played. Like, you're still seeing what you've seen, but now you're dissecting it to a greater level. And you're trying to watch them away from the play or just in certain situations, over time, consistency, attitude, everything. You're just watching in a whole different level, but it's still very, very much natural because I watch so many hockey games. It was a really nice transition to jump in. I think the biggest learning curve for me was, first of all, learning the players I didn't know well and learning a lot of them. And then also learning how to file reports, what our GM and assistant GMs want, and just kind of learning that learning curve was what I knew I had to be patient with. And I've had a lot of reps over the last year and a half. So it's been really interesting and really fun. I'm really enjoying it, actually.
Cammy, how do your discussions with Ray differ than your discussions with your brothers?
Well, with Ray, I would like to think that we have more of an equality. With me, I'm a fifth sibling. I don't know if anyone is a younger sibling and you understand where you are in the pecking order. You know, with my family, when you get back with your family, no matter how old you are, you just fall right back into who you are as a sibling, right? So,
yeah.
You know, my voice is a bit muted with my brothers, but there's certainly been some great discussions with my brothers over the last year and a half with, you know, Don's in the NHL and Tony's was coaching in the NHL and now in college, so he knows the younger players. We've had some awesome discussions over players, and it's been really fun as a scout now to talk to them because it's a lot deeper of a conversation. I'm really listening to what they have to say. Just as information for me. So it's been great.
50 years ago, it happened. Ali Frazier won Monday, March 8th, 1971. Ali was undefeated, 31-0, 25 knockouts. Frazier was 26-0 with 23 knockouts. It was a fight that came to be known as the fight of the century. And I doubt that anybody gathered around these microphones would dispute that. Teddy Atlas, trainer, fight commentator, joins us. Great to see you again. It's been a while, Teddy. You look good. And Paul Jones is with us as well. You guys were both youngish at the time of this fight, both teenagers when this fight took place. In general, what are your recollections, Teddy?
I lost $120. I was 14 years old. I lost 120. I had no idea how I was going to pay it back. And all I knew was I had to figure it out. I could not believe that my man, Muhammad Ali, and that speaks to, well, it speaks obviously to his influence, you know, that he's got a 14-year-old kid that's believing in him so much. There's no way Muhammad could lose. There's just no way. He can't lose this fight. I'll just make $140. And I learned a lesson. I learned a lesson. And I came up, like Ali got off the floor, I came up with the 120. That was almost as hard. It was almost as hard as what Muhammad had to do.
Oh, Bobcat, I was 12, going to be 13. And I remember as a young black kid how important the fight was in our community because there was a division between Joe and Muhammad, who had recently changed his name and wouldn't go into the army and all of that. And I remember being at home with my brother, who's, you know, now Mr. ESPN, he was 9 years old. And we sat at the kitchen table while my dad and his cronies tooted off to the Vaughn Theater to watch the fight in closed circuit. And my mom, my brother, and I sat at the kitchen table. We were allowed to stay up in our pajamas, listening for, as my brother called it, the Up One reports, which is really the UPI reports on the round by round, where they said, you know, first round ends, Ali and Frazier meet in the middle. Frazier hits him to the body. Ali goes back to the ropes. You get a 20-second little summation. Yep. And they said, end of round one, UPI scores the round for Frazier. And I was writing them down. And that's what I remember. And Teddy, I was like you. I just could not believe anybody could beat Muhammad. I was in that same boat.
John Shannon, what are your recollections?
I tell you what, it was, to me, it was bigger than a fight, and Paul touched on it. This was a return of someone who, a conscientious objector, someone who had made a political and a religious stand about the Vietnam War, someone who was so influential that this was not just a fight. This was a social, political event, I was in high school. I was listening on the radio. I wasn't in Paul's kitchen, but I was in my own. The closest closed circuit to my house was 250 miles away.
Wow!
So we had no choice in a very small town, and we were also. We were right on the Canada-U.S. border, so we were very cognizant of the Vietnam War. We had a ton of draft dodgers. We were a very liberal-leaning town. So the town was really divided between the fight and, you know, and the guy who didn't want to go to war. And it became a huge discussion around our kitchen table on a nightly basis leading up to the Monday. And by the way, the fact that it was a Monday,
yes,
also spoke to the event being so special. This was not a Saturday. This was not even a Sunday, but this was a Monday. This is before Monday Night Football was invented. This was something that was so special on a school night that it became so important to everyone.
It's intriguing, guys, that the question of race comes up in a confrontation between two black fighters. And yet race was really an issue in this fight. Ali was, we all know what his personality was like. We all know what his agendas were up until that point. And if you were white and were racist at all, you hated Muhammad Ali and therefore adopted Joe Frazier as the guy that you were rooting for. It's... I'm not sure, Teddy, that we've seen a fight quite like this from that perspective. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Joe Frazier said it best. You know, he was hurt. He was really hurt by the people, by everybody, by the black community, by people in general when he once said, you know, I don't understand. They're treating me like I'm not black. And he pointed to his skin color. He said, I'm darker than Muhammad. I'm darker than he is, and they're treating me as though I'm not a black man, and I was less privileged than him. I grew up in South Carolina, you know, as a sharecropper, you know, working out in the fields, you know, very difficult work for very little money. So Joe Frazier was really, you know, cut to his core by not understanding how he could be dismissed as a black man. So yeah, it cut a lot of ways that went way beyond what usually hurts, which is inside that squared circle. There's a lot of hurt outside. There's a lot of healing that needed to take place and adjusting outside that ring, that this ring was sort of this event, as you guys touched on, was sort of a microcosm of all that. It was a center point, a nuclear point.
Yeah.
For all of that. And I got to say one thing. It also was kind of like what Flood in baseball and Catfish Hunter later did in free agency. it was, there is no commission in boxing, no national commission. So there's no official free agency. But this was about free agency too. Fighters had never made this kind of money. They had never, you know, it's just like the baseball owners. They made all the money. And then all of a sudden the baseball players started making money on a more fair level. Well, the same thing with the boxers. The promoters made all the money. And now $5 million purse to split. Wow. I mean, like, it was mind-boggling. Like, nobody ever heard of that. And it opened the doors. It really did. It opened the doors for future purses to be larger. For, again, for free agency, if you will, in boxing. And the story I got to tell you, my friend Mickey Duff, he's one of the greatest promoters of all time from London. They ran everything in London. And he's not with us anymore. But at the time, him and his partner, Jarvis Astaire, he owned Wembley Stadium. That's all you need to know. So the two of them, with his other partners, they were thinking about promoting this fight. It was open. It was open to bidding. And when it got up to $5 million, they had to make a decision. He told me the story himself. He said, Teddy, we had to make a decision. Now, these are guys that are embedded into boxing. Nobody knows boxing better. It's not like they were naive guys. They looked at the numbers, and they didn't make sense. They said, at the end of the day, they went back and forth, and finally, they said, we got to pass. We got to, you sure? Yeah, we got to pass. It's too much. It's too much. And Mickey Duff, even though he's got an Irish name, you guys are boxing guys, you probably know this, he was Jewish. So he was, his real last name was Prager. So it was over after this negotiation, before the fight, he was over in Israel. And he was at, excuse me if I pronounce it wrong, but he had a kibbutz. And he was near the water there. And he's over there in Israel at his kibbutz near the ocean. And he hears these two Hasidics, can you imagine this, talking about this fight. Soon as he heard it, he ran to the phone booth. He called him, he called up London. He called Jarvis and said, Jarvis, we made a huge mistake.
Wow.
Well, wow. And from an economic perspective, here's some numbers. There were 2.5 million tickets sold on the pay-per-view. The fight generated $45 million in revenue, which is the equivalent of over $300 million today. And in Britain, to your point, Teddy, 27.5 million viewers watched the fight on television there. That was half the population of Britain.
Wow.
50% of the population watched this fight. Just to put it in perspective for those that are too young to remember this, how big this event was.
You know, Bobcat, Teddy talks about, you know, the racial side of things. And as a kid sitting on my parents' living room floor, you know, John talked about how in his town they were well aware. Well, we were well aware of the civil rights movement. And as a kid sitting watching that, I think what happened was Muhammad, when he changed his name and he stood up and he said all these things, he was speaking for a lot of the Black community that didn't have a voice. He was their, well, champion, so to speak, in a number of ways. And I don't know if people disliked Joe as much as they felt that it's the old silence is complicit. And he didn't speak up as much. And I that was my perspective as a kid back then. Like, well, he's Black. I was like, you, Teddy, he's Black too. Why are you saying he's the white people's champion? And why are you? And it was because maybe the perception was that Joe wasn't speaking up enough. And his personality, you know, as we know, maybe didn't lend itself to that. He was, as Teddy said, a hardworking blue collar guy. And he just kind of kept his mouth quiet and did his job at the time because there was maybe a fear of reprisal or retribution if you spoke up too much. So
I would tell you, Paul, that he played by the rules.
Yes.
You know, and what happened was, let's face it, Ali, to his credit, wrote his own rules.
Yes. And he spoke up, John. And that was the thing. And that,
well, that was part of the rules he created.
Right. That was new for some Black people. They wanted to speak up. They saw injustice, but he was the first one you know, on that scale and that global perspective, to say to America, I'm not doing this. And for him, it had been brewing for a long time. We know what he did with his medal when he came back from the Olympics, and it had been brewing for a long time, and he just let it out.
With Teddy Atlas and Paul Jones, as we reflect on the 50th anniversary today of the Ali Frazier fight, the first Ali Frazier fight. Joe Frazier had been fighting pretty consistently leading up to this confrontation. Ali had a couple of fights after his forced retirement from the sport. Teddy, as a trainer, I'm intrigued by your response to this question. Did Ali fight Frazier too soon? Should he have had one, two more tune-up fights, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, definitely. Yes. But first of all, it was pretty incredible what he did. 3.5 years old off, and he comes back and he fights as tune-ups. He fights Oscar Bonafina and Jerry Quarry. I mean, if you put that to today's standards, those are top guys. Those aren't tune-ups. I mean, these are guys that are fighting for titles. These are top guys. These are top contenders. And it was part of the metamorphosis of Ali, the change of Ali, too, in different ways, in coming out the way he did socially and everything, but also what he was doing, but also physically. You never saw, and technically, you never saw the same. And my mentor, the great Customato, once said, before the enforced layoff, the only time you touched hands, you touched Ali, was when the referee forced you to touch gloves before the fight. And, you know, I know Henry Cooper touched them and all the, you know, Doug Jones on the way up. But once he got to that place, it was pretty damn hard to touch him. And he was a different guy now. He had to be a different guy now. And he was never known as a puncher. Well, now he had to sit down. He had to fight more. He dropped Oscar Bonafina. Joe Frazier fought him twice. He didn't drop him. Joe Frazier, great puncher. He didn't, and he's known as a great puncher. But he didn't drop him. But Ali dropped Bonavena and stopped Bonavena. So it's very interesting. So there was a new Ali now, and he had to be. He had no choice, but he reinvented himself, kind of like George Foreman did years later, you know, and reinvented himself. But George did it more on the person scale, the personality scale, than he really did so much in the ring. But what was really interesting was that he comes back and he has these two fights in short period of time. And then he goes into that fight. And I think a lot of people get the misnomer that it was a one-sided fight. Oh my God, it was a brutal, close, tough fight. I mean, Frazier separated himself at the end with the left hook that dropped Ali. He separated and, you know, put the fight away for himself. But that was a difficult fight for both men, and very difficult for Frazier. He was in the hospital after that fight. A lot of people forget. He had to actually go and spend some time in the hospital. He took a lot of punishment. Ali, having said that he needed more time, to your question, I'm going to turn around. I don't care if it sounds conflictive, but he was great. He was great that night as a new Ali in a new form.
Yeah.
You know, he was like the body snatchers that come down from the planet and they take over someone else's body. He took over a new body and he had to be a new person, and he fought toe-to-toe with Joe Frazier, and he put a beating on Joe Frazier to the point that he did. And of course, Joe Frazier put a beating on him.
Hey, just, Teddy.
Just for clarity, I want to ask this question to Teddy. Sorry, Paul.
Yeah.
But to your point, Teddy, you know, we saw Ali from the early 60s through 67 dance, move, not get hit. Is it your contention then that Ali in 1971 wasn't capable of dancing?
Yeah.
Or did he do it strategically?
That's a very good, smart question. It really is. No wonder you get big jobs over there. it is the right question. It really is. I believe Ali was very instinctual, very special. And even more than, you know, as bright as he was, as articulate as he was very instinctual. And his instincts told him that he had to fight this fight.
To end the week, our friend Darren Pang of Fox Sports Midwest joins us from St. Louis.
Thank you, Bob.
And Martin Brodeur, senior executive with the New Jersey Devils, also in St. Louis. Now, you're not visiting Pang, are you, Brodeur?
Trying to get some money off of him later on today.
All right. Well, it sounds like a golf game is in order, huh? Now, you wanted to jump in, John?
Well, just the fact, Darren, is that Bob still thinks he's a goaltender. But
once a goaltender, always a goaltender.
Yes,
isn't that right, guys?
Hold on.
That's right.
But both
always Pang, right. Union, right, Marty?
Both Pang and Brodeur, when they played, actually went down to their knees once in a while to stop the puck. Bob, you had the Don Simmons style.
Oh no, I brought the butterfly in before it was popularized. I got a question for you two guys. So in many, many, many years ago, when Mike Palmateer was playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs, we used to have ball hockey games on Sunday mornings. And the thing that drove me crazy about Palmateer was he would never want to play goal in ball hockey. He always wanted to play out. Are you guys in that same – well, Brodeur's nodding already.
Yes.
I'm scared of a ball.
Oh, yeah, right. Did you ever fool around, you know, in the driveway with other guys or did you ever play ball hockey just for fun?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
Oh, yeah. Ask Marty. Marty was a good – in fact, hey, Marty, how about that picture that you had as a kid? Speaking of Mike Palmateer, because Mike Palmateer caught with the wrong hand, the lefty. But Marty, yeah. Don't you have a picture of you as a kid with the equipment the wrong way?
Yeah.
Because that's all you had?
Yeah, because my dad used to be a softball, so I had no choice if I wanted to have any equipment to use it. But we played a lot of street hockey. You know, I was fortunate, you know, to grow up in Montreal and in a nice neighborhood that we're able to play in the streets and at the park. You know, they flooded the some of the rinks outdoors, and so I played a lot of hockey outside of organized hockey. And every time I won the Stanley Cup, I brought this Stanley Cup back to my own town, and all the guys that we used to play street hockey, we played for the Stanley Cup that day, like a full fledged and. It was funny. Guys were a little out of shape at times, but we had a great time. Won it twice, lost once, so I was still above 500.
That's fantastic.
It's funny you say that. I've been talking a lot about hockey in Quebec, whether it's with just individuals or with people on other podcasts. I think there's a greater passion for the game of hockey in the province of Quebec than anywhere else in the world. I think when you would come into town, it was early on before they moved to the Bell Center, Wilson Center, whatever it is now, you probably played at the Forum a couple of times as a pro. There's something special about hockey in Quebec and in Montreal, isn't there?
Yeah. It's, like I said, I was really fortunate. Like my dad used to work for the Canadians as a photographer. So I was really close with the organization, but when I would come to Montreal, it's probably not because I'm French Canadian, but like just the atmosphere of a hockey day, like when the Saturday, you know, like usually there's nobody in Montreal in downtown because it's not a work day, but the vibe, you went anywhere, you took a taxi cab, you walked around, you went to get a coffee at Tim Hortons. Everything is about the game. It's a fun feeling. Like, you know, you're somewhere. I played in New Jersey, trust me, Saturday afternoon, you didn't know there was a hockey game when you walked around town.
Was that way for you, Panger, when you went to Montreal?
Well, yeah. You know what, Bob? I grew up, obviously, in Ottawa, so The closest that we had to an NHL team, besides my favorite Ottawa 67s that I grew up idolizing, because that's all we had there. But, you know, I was a Montreal Canadiens fan. I had Avon Cornway and Ken Dryden and Lafleur and Lapointe. I had all those posters were wrapped around my room. And I think I love the Montreal Canadiens because they were winners. I mean, that's, you know, no offense to Toronto at the time, but, you know, that was going through that 70s. They weren't winning anything. And I gravitated towards the Montreal Canadiens. And I remember the first time I got to go to the Montreal Forum, it was during the 76 Canada Cup. My dad brought me there so I could watch Rogge Vachon play for Team Canada. I'm not sure. I think they might have played Sweden. And we sat way up high, but I got to go to the Montreal Forum and I got to watch my hero Rogge Vachon. And it was it kept me motivated my whole life to say that if I could ever play in the Montreal Forum, then that would be, you know, that's what keeps you motivated when maybe there was another path on the road that you could go to with your 13 and 14 and 15 year old friends. But I kept it straight and I kept it highly motivated because of that. So the first game I played in Montreal, it was incredible. I had so many relatives and friends that were there. And every time I looked around, I'd see somebody and lost the game to Patrick Roy, I think 2-0 at the time. But I just thought, wow, I survived that game. I threw up before it. I was so nervous, but it was exhilarating. It was like nothing I'd ever experienced after that again.
Hey, Marty, and people should know, you talked about your dad working for Canadians. He was one of the greatest hockey photographers of all time. And some of his greatest work is in the Hall of Fame and was also has an Olympic medal. I think 1956, if I'm not correct. I think that's right.
That's correct. Yeah.
Would he sneak in? Would he sneak into the game? Let's be honest now. You don't, you don't have to worry about paying
you
for tickets.
You won't get charged
anymore.
Now.
Yeah, no, exactly. you know what? So two different ways. I would, he would pay me like $5 to carry his camera bag. So I would go to practice. And I was his, it was his carrier. So I had to carry the bag around and I got to see a few practices, some photo shoots of players that he had to do. And once in a while, he would bring me, and he always had two seats right along the ice, offensive and defensive. And he would give me a camera and he said, well, just go ahead and take some pictures. And so we would rotate with the brothers who was going to go. But yeah, I went there a few times and that's where I decided, you know what? I don't want to be the guy taking the pictures. I'd like to be the guy that is somebody's taking the picture of me instead.
Oh, that's great.
With Darren Pang and Marty Brodeur, something that was said a little bit earlier, I want to focus on. I may be 100% wrong in this, but most of my life, there has been a goaltender in the National Hockey League who has been the acknowledged best. Now, maybe not the whole time, but Marty, you were one of them for a rather long period of time. Panger, you mentioned Patrick.
No, Panger wasn't one of them.
No, you mentioned Patrick.
Sorry, Darren.
You mentioned Roy, and he certainly would have been in that category. So it inspires me to ask the question, who's the best right now? Who's that guy? If you did a ballot, a vote, somebody that would win hands down as the best?
For me, Bob, it'd be Vasilevsky for his body of work the last couple of years. I think he's the clear-cut guy. And I think that we often forget where Carey Price is just because they haven't been in the limelight, but I would put Carey Price right there at number two. So those would be my guys, Marty. It is hard though, because once you forget about a guy for a year, like last year, we would have said this and you probably would have said Sergei Bobrovsky somewhere in there. And this year I could barely get him in my top 10 when I did something for NHL Network. So I think that's kind of where I am right now, but I never forget about Carey Price. I think putting him in a winning environment, we saw what we know what that guy can do. What about you, Mark?
I agree. You know, I think for me, Carey Price is still the best. I think he showed it in the bubble, dominant. And, you know, if it wasn't for him, I know Montreal is taking some great steps, but he was the reason why they moved on and played so well and looked so good. Vasilevsky, you know, like you said, is right now on top of his game. He's playing on a good team. He's doing the right things for his hockey club to win. But I think that's the beauty of hockey right now. There's a lot of talent out there. There's a lot of good goalies. There's a lot of good forwards and defensemen. Every single year, you have to earn that right to be the best. And then that's why you have to appreciate the Ovechkins and the Crosby, because they're always mentioned still. And, I mean, they've been around for a long time. There's a lot of kids coming up that are pushing the envelope to make this game as good as it is now. I'm talking about the Matthews, the McDavids, you know, the Barzell. I mean, talent is everywhere. Compared when I played, you could probably name five of them for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Now, every single year, there's a guy that's coming out of the woodworks and goes, wow, this guy, I didn't know he was how talented he was. And some guys are getting different opportunities in different areas too that could prove that, you know, and show their talents.
I may be more excited about the next wave of goaltenders than I am about the current crop right now. And you got one of them, Mackenzie Blackwood, you got Shesterov, you got Askarov that was drafted in the first round. I think this next group of goaltending are going to be unbelievable for me anyway.
Well, and hey, listen, the kid across the river in New York and Shesterkin. Might be the best of them all.
Yep.
Might be the best of them all. I mean, what I want to know is that, Marty, when, you know, one of the things that you were famous for was you played a lot of games. Now, you played behind a really good defense, but you played a lot of games. Are we going to see that happen ever again? Are we going to see a 65 to 75 game goalie ever again in the National Hockey League?
No, if it's... but if a team, any successful team won't have to do that. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting a call. Sorry about that. yeah. So like I said, like, I don't think it's going to happen a lot. But again, if I think a team is stuck and needs to put the guy in to win games, it might get close to 65, but the reasoning, like, I just spent 3 days with our coaches in New Jersey and we reviewed tapes, and hockey's fast. Like the power play, the amount of time that is spent in zones now, you know, the overtime, you know, the 3-on-3, the shootouts. It's a lot of hockey, you know, and I don't think guys are made for it anymore. It's just kind of the way it is. And there's better goalies. You know, now you need both goalies to, you know, to be successful. So, yeah, the days of guys like me and you know, Lundqvist at one point, mm-hmm. or Oldby and Luongo, I think it's gone. I mean, I think it's just the game is two-dimensional.
Well, the other part of that is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that goaltenders are expected to practice a lot harder than they used to as well. And how much wear and tear on the body in practice?
Yeah, that's a good point, because I remember, like, I was really worried about the way I practice. You know, sometimes I would go on the ice all the time, but I would go on the ice for 20 minutes out of the 50 minutes, you know, and move on and get ready for my game. Now, I mean, teams, you know, the way they prepare, like, you know, I'm part of an organization and I see the practice habits. I mean, guys are going full on hard. And the disregard about goaltending and practices, it's amazing. Like, nobody shot a puck over my you know, my hips. You know, when I practice. Now, these guys are keying up. Like, oh, my God. I feel bad for them.
Well, but, I tell you what, if somebody put it over...
More demanding.
If somebody put it over your head, you'd be going... there'd be a two-hander somewhere, too.
Yeah. Or a trip to the minors, one or the other.
Yeah, not for you. That's right.
Look, I've said this a million times and been criticized a million times for it, but I really think this whole notion that goaltenders need more rest is poppycock.
Here we go.
I agree.
Well, let's get right to it. Brodeur, you played virtually every other night for most of your career. Panger, you would have played if they'd given you the opportunity, wouldn't you? I mean, goaltenders are ready to play every night.
That's what you want to do.
Of course you do. You don't want to sit. You don't want your ass glued to the bench for 60 mm-hmm. minutes watching somebody else. This whole idea that goaltenders can't play more than 65 games in a season because they get too tired is just absurd. It is ridiculous. And if you got to take a day off, okay, here's two goaltenders. Wouldn't you rather take a practice day off? Hanger.
For sure. I listen, it makes no sense whatsoever. You are absolutely correct. You got a defenseman goes up against the other team's best player and plays 32 minutes a night. They get on the ice the next day for a skate. The goaltender, depending on, and this is where probably Marty and his staff look at things a little differently than what we did, but the quality of time in your zone. Let's say, Bob, for example, your team, you had 12 minor penalties the night before. You're in Dallas, central time zone, and, you know, you're under siege the whole time, and you're pushing post to post and up. That could be an exhausting game, whereas you're turning that around and you're going to fly 3.5 hours, you're going to get, you know, to Detroit, and you're going to lose time or whatever. So there are circumstances where I totally understand managing the schedule, but by and large, you don't often face that type of stress during the course of a night. And when you have a conversation with the goalie, if he's on a roll and seeing the puck great, he wants to get back out there, because those are the prime times for a goaltender when you're rhythmic like that and everything's coming at you slowly. You might as well play the darn goalie rather than put somebody else in and then things don't go so well and you've got a hot goalie sitting on the bench. So Mark, I do agree with part of that. Yep.
Marty, was it always your decision? Like whether it was Burns or Lemaire or Robinson or Fedorik for that brief period, was it always your decision?
So what we did, like, I had my goalie coach Jacques Caron that we had a really good relationship with, and we would sit and we would make a monthly schedule. And we would obliged by it almost 100%. Didn't matter my performance. So I would say it was 3 games in 4 nights. I had to pick one of those games. They felt comfortable for me to take a break. I would just and they, but like I said, that's all my games. My bad, because I'm sure it was not that. But I was making my own schedule, so I knew exactly when I was going to play, where my day off is going to be, where I could push in practice, where I have to take a little break. And everything was scheduled like that, so everybody knew exactly. For the most part, it was like that. Later on, my career got a little different. But for the most part, not that I decided, they wanted me to play. And that's one of the reasons, like, I stayed in New Jersey, because I had such a, like, everybody trusted me there. So it didn't matter how I played. I knew lose or win a game, didn't matter. I was going to play again. So to have that comfort as a goalie, it's pretty amazing. That's huge. And you could keep on rolling. And like Banger said, like, sometimes you're feeling it. That ball, it comes in like a beach ball. You know, that puck, sorry. Like, and it's crazy. And other nights are a little tougher. But, you know, And even there's years that I would look, we were down 3-0 in the third, I would say just, get me out of there. You know, I would take a look at Johnny Mack or the assistant coach at the time and said, you know what, give the other guy a little game. The game is over. We're not getting it. We did it in the playoffs. I did it in the game 6 of the Stanley Cup Finals. I started the third period, and they scored a quick goal. The game was 4-5-1. And I looked, I was like, just pull me. Let me get for 20, you know. And not just the kind of relationship I had with the organization. So I was really, really fortunate. Not many people had that.
I tell you what, it's ironic you say that, or maybe it's coincidence that you say
Montreal.
That.
Montreal.
Based on 25 years ago this week.
Yes.
25 years. Darren, you were there.
I was, yes.
And Patrick Roy at 7-1. Patrick Roy wanted out. And Mario wouldn't put him. And at 9-1... he pulled him, and Patrick never played another minute for the hockey club because he felt he was being embarrassed by the hockey club. So
that was something else, wasn't it?
Oh.
That was something.
I saw the clip.
Marty, how old were you when you? Yeah, how old were you when that happened?
That was 96. I was in the NHL.
It was December 2nd, 1995. And it changed the balance of power. It changed the balance of power from east to west. And with all due respect to you, Marty, it really actually, you were in the NHL by then, because you remember you won the cup in, you won the cup in 95 in the short season.
Yeah.
It really took Montreal out of play for a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something else. That was, you know what? Think of everything that happened that night. First of all, the hands going up, the Russian five just dominating, the fact there was no glass behind the bench, which you'd never have again. He'd have to try to, he'd be trying to knock on the, excuse me.
And presidents don't stand behind the bench like that anymore either.
And he goes right by Mario Tremblay, looks at him, and then takes a U-turn, button hooks it right back again. Oh my goodness, that was something else.
It was wild TV. It was wild TV, I can tell you that. It's the fascination about that night for Canadians across the country is that that game was only seen in the province of Quebec on Hockey Night in Canada in English. It was seen on La Soirée de Hockey in French. It was only seen on Hockey Night in Canada in the province of Quebec, and yet every Canadian claims they watched it.
Yeah.
Every Canadian says, I remember when I saw that. And that was the magic of, and again, my own personal view, the magic of what Hockey Night in Canada and those Saturdays that we talk about in Montreal and how important and special Saturdays in Montreal were for the whole country.
Yeah. That was amazing. Like I remember growing up, that's all we did. We ordered food and we sat there and we, you know, later on it was with buddies. Before that was with families. You know, it's something just special. You built the great relationship with your friends and family because of La Soirée du Hockey.
Hey, Marty, I got to ask you something. Bob and I for years have had a good friend of yours, and we'd like to think he's a good friend of ours on, and that's Lou Lamoriello. And I can tell you in the 25 times we had Lou on the radio show, he told us absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. he made us feel special. He made us feel special. It was really, I mean, it was warm conversation, but there was not one iota of information in anything that Lou would tell us, zero. I want to know what you learned from Lou and what Lou means to you.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I was really fortunate to kind of to grow up in an organization led by Lou. You know, I think it's just the passion. I think he's a guy that, yes, he's serious. Yes, he won't tell you anything, but he cares a lot. You know, he's a person that, you know, whenever anything happens in your career, regardless if it's on the personal level, on the hockey level, he's going to be genuine about it, and he's going to do everything he can in his power to help you. And he's got a huge heart. Like, people don't see that much of him because he's just kind of so serious, and he's so driven to do everything he can to make his team a winning hockey team. And that was the beauty for us. Like, we knew exactly, like, every time there's a deadline, he was going to do everything possible to get our team better. You know, sometimes he knew that we're not going to make it. He would pull the ring a little bit. But when he felt that we had a chance to win, if you look at every single time that we had a chance to win or we won, the moves that we made at the deadline or sometimes maybe a month before the deadline, so he would kind of try to beat the traffic, you know, and made some great deals. And, you know, Alex McGillney and Malkov and a bunch of stuff like that. So for me, it means the world. Still communicate with him at least once a month, you know, regardless if it's for hockey or just personal things. You know, I got to know the family really well, and he's got to know my family really well. So the relationship is great. And like I said, I was lucky. I've been other places. There's people that are doing a great job. I work with Doug Armstrong and stuff. And everybody that I work with, they all, same question you just asked me. They
want to know. We don't want to keep you from your golf game. Of course, we're extremely sympathetic to that, and because it's we're getting wet snow here in Toronto, we couldn't give a flying fadoo about you two and your golf game. So, but we'll let you carry on and enjoy yourselves the rest of the day. It's always good to see both of you, and thanks a lot for taking a few minutes for us here, and have a good day. And you know, we'll talk down the road, I hope. Thanks, guys. So there you go. Some of the best of the Bob McCowan podcast from the past 12 months as we take a little vacation here, to the chagrin of the audience, I'm sure.
Well, not much of a vacation when you think of what's going on in the world, Bob. still, but you know what? It's a good time to spend your family. Good time to have some quiet time, enjoy some eggnog and some festive spirit.
Happy holidays to y'all from John and I, and we'll see you in the first week of January. Goodbye, everybody.